22-1415 TechSec v. IBM.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Michael Oakes for the plaintiff, TechSec, Inc. TechSec has brought this appeal primarily to correct two claim construction decisions made by the District Court, both which relate to a phrase found in the preamble of the asserted claim.
Are these the same claim construction arguments, or are we talking about the same claims that were subject to the case that came before us?
Yes, Your Honor. These are the same terms and the same constructions that are at issue here. The defendants have asserted that collateral estoppel precludes this appeal because these claims were appealed in a case against IBM related to a summary judgment of no infringement against IBM. And defendants bear the burden of proving that collateral estoppel applies under a five-factor test set forth under Fourth Circuit law, and they must show that each of those five elements are present for collateral estoppel to apply. And defendants cannot meet their burden with respect to two of those prongs. The second prong of the five-factor test, that the claim construction rulings were necessary to the District Court's judgment, and the third prong, that this Court necessarily decided those claim construction rulings on the first appeal by summarily affirming the judgment of no infringement. For the necessary to the judgment prong, under Fourth Circuit law, C.B. Marchand versus Eastern Foods, the Fourth Circuit adopted the modern rule which is set forth in the second restatement of judgment. And that is, if a district court sets forth multiple independent grounds for its ruling and judgment, neither one standing alone is considered necessary and essential to the judgment for collateral estoppel purposes.
And the last time around, there were arguments both with respect to claim construction and with respect to a failure of evidence, failure of proof.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And the district court's opinion clearly sets forth those. The first independent ground for no infringement goes through the lack of evidence, even under TechSec's theory. So the heading is under 1 and 2 of the district court's non-infringement section. It says, even under TechSec's theory, and it goes through a lack of evidence. And only after going through that 16 pages of the court's analysis, there's heading number 3, which says, the accused product do not meet the required claim limitations. And this, I'll just read the words from the court's, the beginning of that opinion. It said, A38 said, in addition to TechSec's failure to produce evidence supporting its allegations, plaintiff's allegations are also untenable as a matter of law because there is no genuine dispute that IBM's products do not meet all of the required claim limitations.
And all of these issues are on appeal, and so your argument, as I understand it, is that the Court Rule 36, we have no basis for knowing which arguments and issues were necessarily decided.
That's right, Your Honor. So IBM argued in its brief.
But doesn't the district court say that it construed only those terms that were strictly necessary to the resolution of the party's motion? So we know exactly what claims were construed.
That's right. They were strictly necessary for that second ground of no infringement. In the first ground, it doesn't apply the claim construction rulings at all. There's no mention of the claim construction rulings. And the third ruling would be superfluous if they were applying the claims in the first instance.
So the argument with respect to the evidentiary failing was that there was insufficient evidence no matter what the claim construction was.
That's correct, Your Honor. IBM argued in its brief, you do not need to address claim construction because you can summarily affirm solely on a lack of evidence. And this court asked clarification during argument that time. Said, do we need to decide claim construction? IBM's counsel said, no, you don't. You may summarily affirm solely based on a lack of evidence. And this court, in other cases like Verizon v. Cox FiberNet, we cited, and Paradox Security, will look at cases like this and say, we don't need to address claim construction. We can decide this based on a lack of evidence and just affirm a judgment of no infringement.
Well, assuming that the claim construction is still in play, tell us why you think the district court misconstrued the multi-level, multimedia security phrase.
Yes, Your Honor. So the 702 family of patents, we're talking about four patents that descend from a common specification. It provides systems and methods for securing data objects using both access control and encryption at the object level. And you can see that as it goes through, it's column 2, lines 5 through 7, it's discussing the prior art, but it's doing it in the context of what the invention is. The simple encryption of data being communicated between two points only provides one level of security. And then at column 2, lines 31 through 34, it says a secure method of labeling files can provide a level of protection in addition to cryptographic protection.
But you've got some prosecution history that gets in the way, doesn't it?
Your Honor, yes, the defendants have asserted that there's some kind of prosecution disclaimer, but I think if you look at the context of the patents in terms of the claims, the specification, and the prosecution history as a whole, it's very clear that what they're claiming here is only one level of encryption is required. Two can be used, five can be used, infinite numbers as long as you have enough storage of encryption can be used, but only one is required, and you can see that in Claim 1 of the 702 patent. So it talks about labeling the object, encrypting the object, reading the object label. Some of the inside cover is also at A156.
But the specification was amended at appendix page 427.
There is
the language I'm referring
to. I do, Your Honor.
And that's pretty clear, pretty strong language, and it was in response to an indefiniteness rejection, so it matters, does it not?
It matters, but there's actually three things that happened in response to that indefinite rejection. First of all, claims were amended. So the examiner said, you're missing essential steps in Claim 1, it's indefinite. You're missing the steps of labeling a message, reading a message label, encrypting a message, and decrypting a message. Again, the singular, there's only one thing being encrypted there. So the examiner didn't think a second layer of encryption was an essential step. It's inconceivable that the examiner would be looking at the essential steps of a method claim and ignore the fact that there's no encryption of a second object there. It's not required under Claim 1. It is required under Claim 4. So if you look at Claim 4 of the 702 patent, that's the first time that encrypting a second object is discussed. So it says in Claim 1, you only need...
But the preamble of the claim talks about the multi-level multimedia security.
Right. It says...
It's just talking about how you encrypt one level.
Well, you have to read in three, four, or five steps into the preamble in order to get a second layer of encryption. Those steps are not required under Claim 1. The examiner said, here are the essential steps. The essential steps to achieve multi-level multimedia security are reading an object label, encrypting an object, just a singular object. Those are the essential steps. Not encrypting two objects. That's in Claim 4. That's a dependent claim off of Claim 1. So when you get to Claim 4, you're now embedding that object that you encrypted in Claim 1 into a second object and encrypting the second object.
Same arguments you've made before that were made before in the original case?
These are the arguments that were made in the brief. There was very little oral argument on the claim construction issues. It was primarily focused on evidentiary issues. But yes, these are the same arguments, the same constructions that we're proposing here. The defendants have adopted the district court's constructions, obviously, and are making similar arguments.
So the court has heard arguments twice on this issue, and now you're asking us to hear arguments again on the same claim construction issue?
This court has heard argument once.
But it was on the prior argument was based on these exact same claims.
Correct, Your Honor. But under collateral estoppel, to preclude a second appeal, the Supreme Court has said that a summary affirmance can be nothing more than what is necessary and essential to sustain that judgment.
What about our mandate rule?
Well, the mandate rule applies to what happens to a district court. The Fourth Circuit is pretty clear in Doe v. Child that the mandate rule doesn't have any applicability to what an appeals court can do. So the mandate rule would preclude, in theory, something that a district court could do on remand if it was within the scope of the mandate. But again, for collateral estoppel and the mandate rule, we're applying Fourth Circuit law. And if these aren't necessary and essential to the Federal Circuit's prior judgment, and we can't read that into a summary affirmance.
But when we decided the prior case under our Rule 36, weren't we essentially settling all the issues that were brought before us at that time?
No, Your Honor, only the issues that were necessary and essential to sustain that judgment.
But you argued these same claim constructions before us, and we ruled on the basis of a Rule 36.
But those weren't necessary to sustain a judgment of non-infringement. The court asked, do we need to address claim construction? IBM responded no, and this court's precedent is clear that it doesn't.
You responded yes.
Well, certainly we wanted to have the claims construed for the very reason that we didn't want them.
You got them construed.
Where, Your Honor?
Well, the district court construed them.
Right. We wanted the Federal Circuit to review them. That was the point of the first.
We did. We reviewed the case and we affirmed the claim construction on the basis of a Rule 36.
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court said no. The summary affirmance, you can't read in things to a summary affirmance. Only what's essential to sustain the judgment. And those claim construction rulings weren't essential to sustain that judgment. This court could have affirmed based on a lack of evidence. That was an alternative ground presented by the district court. But that's straight Fourth Circuit law. If there's alternative ground, neither one is necessary and essential to the judgment. So a Rule 36 summary affirmance does not import those claim constructions into it. I'd like to turn a little bit.
So let's say we've heard you now. Let's say we assume that you've made it past collateral estoppel. You've made it past the mandate rule. Now you're before us. You're arguing the same arguments. Why shouldn't we just summarily affirm the district court right now from the bench?
I think because the claim constructions are clearly wrong. If you look at Claim 1, you'll see that only one layer of encryption is required by the claims. If you look at the specification, it says specifically that DCOM, the invention is called DCOM. It says, this is at A153, column 5, lines 18 through 28. It says, the present invention, known as the distributed cryptographic object method, can securely manage and track a single encrypted object or encrypted object embedded within other encrypted objects. So again, only one layer of encryption is required. More can be done, but one is required. So Claim 1, only one level. Claim 4, two or more levels.
Is this a new argument here?
The same argument.
It's the same argument.
Same argument.
I'm having a hard time seeing why you should get two bites at the apple.
Your Honor, because the summary affirmance does not necessarily affirm those claim constructions with rulings, that's what the Fourth Circuit's collateral estoppel rules are for, is to protect the litigant when it's not clear from a judgment whether those were, and it's clear that they weren't necessary and essential to the district court's judgment. That means they couldn't be necessary and essential to the Federal Circuit's judgment.
The district court said it construed only those terms that were strictly necessary to resolution of the party's motions.
It says that, but then if you actually read the opinion, if you look at A24 through A38, which is the first section, the non-infringement based on no evidence. There's no discussion of the claim terms. It says it's under Tex-Ex theory, so that's applying our claim constructions. There's no evidence of infringement. So that does not incorporate...
Can I ask you to move on to indefiniteness? Which one?
I'm sorry.
Move on to indefiniteness, please. Meaningful function.
Sure.
I want you to hit your meaningful function.
Okay. I do want to hit multimedia because it's critical for all the defendants. But
yeah, but we've already covered that.
Okay.
So move on.
Sure.
Your time is expiring. You're eating into your rebuttal
okay.
time.
So meaningful function, there's a number of terms in there. For Claim 8, system memory means, we've asserted, is not meaningful function. It uses means, but the structure within the claim itself overcomes the presumption. Memory is memory. The only function that's described is storing data, so there's nothing special about it. Memory stores data, and even if it is meaningless function, the claim is, or the specification discloses RAM as memory that can store data. So it's either not meaningless function at all, or the structure is there for storing data. Memory is memory.
What about RAM digital logic?
Digital logic. It's not meaningful function. Digital logic doesn't actually have a function associated with it. It's just digital logic means, but the claims use digital logic sort of interchangeably with digital logic means. And then underneath digital logic, there's five sub-elements, and those are the structure. They're actually in structural terms, not meaningful function terms. So the structure is actually disclosed within the claim itself. So those are all structural components. The only one that I think system memory means is in there, but again, that's just memory. The other ones are actually presumed to have the structure, so there's actually no structure that's lacking there.
Is a module containing an algorithm structure?
It is, Your Honor. It's not in meaningful function format, so it would be up to the defendants to overcome that presumption, but it's a the modules are actually disclosed as either a Microsoft embedding package or a Microsoft Windows application. So it's a known application that performs a known function. And then to the extent the algorithms are required, they're in prose in the three specific examples laid out in the specification. Very lengthy algorithm in prose format.
Okay, why don't we hear from Mr. Tierney, and we'll restore your rebuttal time, Mr. Oakes.
I'd like to address the substances of the constructions that TechSec has raised, but I would like to point out a little bit about how we got here for 1 second, because I do think it's relevant to at least the question that Judge Rayna asked about the mandate rule, which is the way we got here was there was a case that TechSec chose to bring against a number of defendants. Judge Branko decided to go forward against one defendant, IBM, first. TechSec and IBM litigated. She construed the claims, as you pointed out, that were strictly necessary, the terms, other terms she did not construe, and she issued a summary judgment based on IBM's motion. At that point, TechSec had a choice. TechSec, at that point, could have said, okay, let's now go back against the other defendants, but they didn't choose that. What they chose to do was take a Rule 54B appeal to this court. They took that Rule 54B, and they lost. At that point, once they lost, the mandate issued in this case...
Yeah, but you make it sound as though that was the only argument that she decided on the basis of IBM. With claim construction, you lose. No. In fact, that was the last argument that she mentioned. Her opinion begins with, under any construction, there is insubstantial evidence in this case to establish infringement, so I find non-infringement. Moreover, claim construction. And so that is exactly what was appealed to the Federal Circuit, and I listened to the oral argument with Judge Lynn and I think Judge Prost, and I listened to it, and it was clear that they were discussing both issues, and either one of which would have been a basis for affirmance. Could arguably be a basis for affirmance.
Your Honor, I wasn't focusing, I apologize if I was ambiguous, I was focusing on the mandate rule for a second. And unlike collateral estoppel, which does focus on this question of essentiality, which we disagree with TechSec on, the mandate rule does not. So as a function of what they did in terms of taking the 54B in this case and then going up to the Court of Appeals and having to go back, at that point the mandate issue. So the question is, what is subsumed within the mandate? And the mandate rule, as specified by Engel versus Lockwarmer, does not have an essentiality question. All the mandate rule does is say, let's take a look at what was the subject of the judgment that was appealed. There is no issue, no dispute, that claim construction and judgment based on claim construction was the subject of the decision appealed.
That was one subject.
It was one subject.
But there was an independent subject and an independent basis on which the district court ruled, and that was the evidentiary failure, regardless of claim construction.
Whether we agree or disagree with that, that goes to the collateral estoppel question. It does not go to application of the mandate rule, because the mandate rule does not go to whether there were independent judgments or whether there was essentiality. It only goes to what went up, what was the subject of the issues that were appealed from the judge below.
So you're saying every time we issue a Rule 36 affirmance, it's an affirmance on every single ground asserted?
Within that case, because once the mandate issue...
But that would substantially broaden Rule 36 between... Nobody has ever made this argument
only
before.
Only in a limited situation where somebody decides to take a Rule 54B judgment appeal and it goes back to the same case and the mandate issues. Because under the mandate rule, what happens is that whatever is not remanded specifically by the Federal Circuit but was within the issues that were appealed from judgment below becomes the subject of the mandate. But I'd be happy to go
Engel forward. Engel was involving a detailed opinion, correct? It wasn't a Rule 36 summary affirmance. Do you have any cases involving the mandate rule which apply to Rule 36?
What was interesting about Engel was that the issue...
No, my question was, do you have any cases that apply the mandate rule to a Rule 36?
No. Well, okay. What was interesting about Engel was that the issue that was subject to the mandate rule there was actually not appealed.
Well, actually, that was the whole issue in Engel. That's not just
exactly.
What's interesting about it. That's why it actually bears no relation to this case, Mr. Cherney. I'm talking, Mr. Cherney. That's why it bears no relation to this case, because in Engel, the real issue was you had an issue you could have appealed. It was within the scope of the judgment. You chose not to. Therefore, we're not going to let you bring it up later. Here they chose to, and they didn't get an answer from the Federal Circuit on that.
They actually appealed it. and got and became the subject of the mandate. In Engle, what happened was is that they did appeal, and it still was the subject of the mandate, even though the Federal Circuit said nothing about the issue about the payment of the royalty license. So you have the same situation where the Federal Circuit has said nothing about the substance.
Hey, Mr. Attorney, move on to the claim construction issues.
So the next question, which was focused on earlier, was multi-level. Now, as Judge Lynn noted, there's quite a bit of discussion in the prosecution history and the specification about multi-level. And in fact, what happened was there was an indefiniteness rejection, and as a result, the patentee amended the specification. And what the patentee said was, specifically about multi-level security, and what you didn't notice from TechSec's argument was, any mention of the intrinsic evidence where it actually defines multi-level security. Totally silent. But what the patentee added was, multi-level security is achieved because encrypted objects may be nested within other objects which are also encrypted, possibly within other objects, resulting in multiple layers of encryption. And TechSec argues that this maybe is permissive. But there's no other discussion at all about how else it may be achieved. And when you look at the language, it's clear that what's being said there is what it may be, is that we have a system that we disclose that has the capability of nesting encrypted objects within other objects. And then that results in multiple layers of encryption.
Well, what about multimedia? He really wanted to get to that, and I moved him to the means plus function, but I understand why he wanted to get to it. I mean, it's in every single claim. And below, they seem to treat it as a noun rather than an adjective, as though it imparted a separate and additional limitation as opposed to just describing what was subject to multiple layers of encryption.
Okay.
And, you know, the multimedia security is what has to be subject to multiple layers of encryption. That's one argument. The argument the lower court seemed to adopt was multimedia, no, is a separate and distinct limitation that imparts something additional.
And I agree with the lower court. And if you take a look at the intrinsic evidence again, what we have here is a situation where, first, in the prosecution history, there was this indefinite rejection. And it was focused on multi-level, multimedia security objects. And in response to that, TechSec, the patentee, argued, okay, these terms take their ordinary meanings. These are not special terms. Take a look at Dyson. Now, multi-level is not in Dyson. And it says these terms, plural, take their ordinary meaning. The only two terms that are in Dyson are multimedia and objects. So you take a look at multimedia, and it's explicitly defined in Dyson. And that's the definition. That definition became part of the intrinsic evidence because that dictionary requirement part of the intrinsic evidence. Then you take a look at the specification, and it goes throughout and makes it clear that multimedia has a separate meaning apart. And if one takes a look at the patent at column 5, lines 8 to 16, it makes it very clear what the multimedia aspect is. It says multi-level multimedia security is defined as the ability to have simultaneous control over the knowledge information flow of numerous media formats while allowing for clear data separation.
What are you reading from?
The patent, A153, column 5, line 8 to 16.
Okay, column 5, line 8
to 16. All right. And it starts off with multi-level multimedia security. And it defines it as the ability to have simultaneous control over the knowledge and information flow of numerous media formats. Not just one media format, numerous and simultaneous. That's why it's multimedia. While allowing for clear data separation. At some level, the multi-level multimedia security becomes transparent. And examples of
there's some ambiguity in that sentence about what simultaneous refers to.
But then we go on.
So referring to the fact that you have different levels simultaneously, at each level there might be different types of media?
It's referring to simultaneous control over the knowledge information flow of the numerous media formats.
Right. That doesn't necessarily mean that each media format has to be multimedia.
Well, no. And when we go to the next line, which I was about to read, it says examples of multimedia objects would include a file that contained two or more of the following. And then the list of media there is actually very similar to the list in Dyson. There's slight differences, but it's the same type of list of different types of media. There's some differences between the list of media. So what the patentee is conveying there is that in order to have multimedia, what you have to have is security of these multimedia objects and simultaneous control, meaning two or more, not one of any type.
But the claims only cover objects. The claims don't cover other things.
No, the claims cover objects, but then the preamble, which limits it by their own admission, by the fact that when the patent office pushed them on indefiniteness, they didn't say this is not a limitation, requires multimedia. So the answer is...
I'm not following you. Numerous media formats could be anything at all, but the claims are limited to objects.
But because they're multi-level, we know that one object encrypted at least into another object. And so the
point that's only if that's only if we agree with you on the definition of multi. You're sort of assuming the answer that you want.
Well, we start off with multi-level, so in some respects, I have to think work hand in hand. So the answer is yes. I do believe, and I do believe since the specification treats them hand in hand in that regard. It says first of all, you have multi-level, which is you have these multiple layers of encryption, and then it talks about multimedia, and multimedia objects are things that have two or more media, and so. In that respect, you have the intrinsic evidence entirely consistent, and what was missing from TechDeck's presentation was any resort to the intrinsic evidence, other than to say, well, the claim is one object. But as Judge Lynn pointed out, you have the preamble throughout, which is a limitation because, as we saw from the prosecution history, the patent office pushed back and said, wait a second, what does this mean? There was no fight about whether it was a limitation. It said, here's what it means. Okay? And then they amended the specification to tell you exactly what it means. It told you that multi-level has to do with the fact that you have encrypted objects with encrypted objects. And yes, obviously I am assuming that, but this is a coherent whole. But then multimedia says, which entirely consistently, is that you have these multimedia objects. What are multimedia objects? Multimedia objects include two or more of the following. So you have an entirely consistent portrayal, which is consistent with what Judge Branko's view was, that is based on the intrinsic evidence. What TechDeck says is, well, it says object. Throughout the entirety of TechDeck's argument, you heard nothing other than it says object. But that doesn't deal with the fact that multi-level multimedia isn't about the word object. It's about the statement in the preamble that we all agree is the meaning. So at this point, what we have is this entirely consistent view of the invention that Judge Brinkman picked up on that's totally consistent with the intrinsic record. So you have multimedia, which they explicitly point to a dictionary. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what their view is. At some point, the public had a right, when they were pushing, what does multimedia mean? To rely on the fact that they then said, it takes its ordinary meaning, and they point to a dictionary as support for that. What was the public supposed to take from that? What was the patent office supposed to take from that? The answer is that they were allowed to take from it that that's what multimedia meant in the context of that limitation. And that's what Judge Brinkman took, and that's how she applied it in the IBM case. Multi-level, they were pushing on that as well. And what did they say? They said multi-level encryption, multi-level security results from the fact that you have encryption with encryption. So the way Judge Brinkman viewed it is entirely consistent with the way this invention works, which is you have multimedia objects that have two or more media from that list of different types of media, not just any type of media, which would essentially render multimedia a moot point, and you have multi-level, which means you have encryption with encryption.
You argue in your brief that if we affirm on claim construction of either multi-level control or multimedia, that we don't really need to get to the means plus function issue.
Well, the means function issue is an interesting one because as Judge Moore picked up on.
No, but my question is that right? If we affirm on either one of the claim constructions, we don't have to get into the indefiniteness problem?
It's a hard question, and I'm trying to answer it in the sense that Judge Lynn, because there's actually no judgment in this case based on the business function. So it's a hard one to answer in the sense that there was a judgment entered in the IBM case. I believe that it is subject to collateral estoppel and that the only validity is one. But in this case, there actually is no judgment yet entered on the business function claims. So it becomes a difficult question to answer in the sense that I do believe the multimedia and multi-level are dispositive.
Oh, just to be clear, so when you said there's no judgment, the district court did hold that TechDeck failed to identify supporting structure for 16 means limitations at 849 of the record, right? And they made a determination.
In the IBM case.
That's in the IBM case.
In this case, what happened was they then went back and there was a discussion about the judgment in this case. And there was an agreement to take judgment on multimedia, agreement on multi-level. But there was no discussion about the Mises function. But the interesting thing is that if it's truly an indefinite opinion and validity, there is no alternative grounds on that ground. So in that sense, it becomes a subject clearly of collateral estoppel. So because, for example, there was no alternative invalidity grounds. And so, but it's an interesting, so I wasn't trying to avoid your question, but it's an interesting thing that happened here.
Well, I had some confusion, so I'm glad that this was not as straightforward as it might otherwise have been.
I'm glad to show you that I'm really confused. And so, but from our perspective, you know, this court can, for example, pick multimedia, and we win. I think we win on multi-level as well. I do agree, you know, despite perhaps some of the disagreement about the mandate rule, that the mandate rule controls, not because this is a broadening of Rule 36, but because in this situation where the plaintiff has made the choice to take a Rule 54B, the mandate has issued in this case, and it subsumes the claim construction. And that is clearly the ruling of the mandate rule, which is anything that is the subject of the appeal, from which it is, the judgment from which it's appealed, that is not excised out and subject to remand becomes part of the mandate. And it is the subject of the mandate here. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Turvey. Ms. Rowe?
Charles, where do we stand with respect to this indefinite question? If we affirm on either one of the claim constructions,
no, Your Honor, I think
it's set
forth in the stipulation and then in the judgment. So multimedia is dispositive for every defendant. So if the court were to affirm on multimedia, that's dispositive for everyone. If the court were to reverse on multimedia but affirm on multi-level security, we believe there are still some defendants who would do this two layers of encryption.
PayPal would be out.
We said PayPal would be out. It's just an encrypted payment transaction. But there are some database products which have full file encryption plus column encryption. So we think there are some that would do two levels of encryption. Again, we don't think that's required, but multimedia is dispositive for everyone. Multi-level.
But what about indefiniteness and the means plus function? It seems like there wasn't any judgment below.
There is no judgment below. Again, this is sort of like Sony versus Thorner that we cited. So we're trying not to do a piecemeal appeal. We'd like to have that decided now because if we get these claim constructions reversed and go back down, then we don't want to have the court immediately say, well, all the means plus function claims are indefinite, and then we'd have to save that for a second appeal. We'd like to get those resolved now. They are not necessary to the district court's judgment or part of the stipulation. But to avoid piecemeal appeals, we think they should be decided now. They're brief. Both sides have argued them. And it's appropriate, and the court does have the opportunity to do that, to avoid that waste of judicial resources. Could I turn to the multimedia terms?
Yeah.
So again, the defendant's argument seems to be that multimedia is an adjective to define object. They keep saying, well, multimedia objects do this, but in the preamble, it's multimedia security, not multimedia objects. The claims themselves only discuss objects, not multimedia objects. And multimedia security, in response to that 112 rejection, in column 4, lines 28, starting line 28, says multimedia security is achieved because objects are encrypted. Not multimedia objects. And then it clarifies that even further. Where other encryption systems only encrypt files or other data, the system of the present invention encrypts any object, encompassing all forms of media. So it's not limited to a certain type of object. It's not a multimedia object. It's any object. And you can see that because the district court's construction excludes every embodiment disclosed in the patent. All three specific embodiments in the patent talk about encrypting and protecting plain text objects in Microsoft Word and WordPerfect. Those aren't multimedia objects, as the district court construed it. It's a plain text object. And if you look at Claim 2, which was added during that same amendment, Claim 2 talks about protecting an application document. So again, the same thing, like a Microsoft Word, a portion of a Microsoft Word document, or a WordPerfect document. The district court's construction reads out Claim 2 altogether. They're requiring some kind of file with video and graphics and a high degree of user interaction, but that's not what the claims and the specification talk about there. So you can't read John Hopkins v. Selbrus, you can't read out every embodiment. There's specific embodiments disclosed, and that construction would read out every single one of those. And so if you look at the prosecution history as a whole, you see an amendment to Claim 1 where the examiner says you're missing the essential steps, and he says the message. Again, the examiner thinks this is just a message or an object-type patent, not a multimedia object patent. And in response, they clarified and said an object is any distinct separate entity, any user-selected group of data. Again, during the same amendment. So they're saying any selected data, not a multimedia file, not a multimedia object. That doesn't appear anywhere in the preamble, and it doesn't appear anywhere in the claim. It's multimedia security, which can protect any object, and then specifically the steps talk about protecting objects, which are defined as any user-selected group of data. So again, this is broad, it's intended to encompass a broad application, so any type of data. Other things can only be filed. We can protect any object, any smaller piece of data, anything, any user-selected group of data within that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Oak. Thank both counsel for their argument. The case is submitted.